This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Deep Survival. Who lives, who dies, and why? True stories of miraculous endurance and sudden death. By Lawrence Gonzalez. For my father. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Dylan Thomas. Prologue. Most children are told fantastic stories, which they gradually come to realize are not true. As I grew up, the fantastic stories I'd heard as a young child turned out to be true. The more I learned, the more fantastic and true the stories seemed. They were unlike the stories other children heard. They were gruesome, improbable, and sad. I didn't repeat them because I thought no one would believe me. They were the stories of a young man falling out of the sky. Unlike Icarus, who had flown too high, he had not flown high enough. At 27,000 feet, his wing was blown off by a German Flak battalion, which was firing 88-millimeter anti-aircraft shells over the rail yards outside of Dusseldorf. And, unlike Icarus, he's still alive as I write this. Federico Gonzalez, my father, was a first lieutenant near the end of World War II. He was piloting a B-17 for the 8th Air Force, when that organization had evolved into a marvelous machine for turning young men into old memories. He was on his 25th and last mission, which he was eager to complete, because he and his buddy, David Swift, were going to sign up to fly P-51 Mustang fighter planes, the Knights of the Sky. My father was like that, despite having been shot down before. He'd enlisted in the last cavalry outfit before the war. He rode horses at a gallop while emptying the clip of his 45 Model 1911A, reloading while turning to come back and hit the targets again. When the war started, the cavalry was mechanized, and he began searching for the next best thing. He discovered airplanes. He went out for fighters, but they needed bomber pilots, and as his commanding officer told me 45 years later, your dad had a flair for flying on instruments. When his B-17 was hit on January 23, 1945, he was the lead pilot for one of those enormous air raids that the United States was conducting at the time. The commandant of the 398th Bomb Group, Colonel Frank Hunter, had asked my father's regular co-pilot to stand down so that he could fly right seat in the lead plane and see the action. The bombers had taken off in great waves of smoke before dawn, formed up, and churned out over the English Channel from Nuthamstead Base. They'd reached the target area and were on the bomb run when ground fire from the Flak battalion cut the left wing of my father's B-17 in half just inboard of the number one engine. It was rotten luck. During the bomb run, you couldn't take evasive action or the bombs would go astray. Moreover, his was the first plane in the formation, and the hit was the very first firing. It was a mortal wound to the plane and 90% fatal to the crew. The blast was deafening, and my father saw immediately that there was going to be no flying out of this. He turned to his boss beside him and said, "Well, I guess this is it." Then the plane rolled over, ignoring my father's attempts to right it, and began some sort of inverted flat spin. He couldn't tell precisely what sort, for the world had turned into a nasty soup of unfamiliar colors. He gave the bailout orders through the intercom to the crew, unsure if the thing was even working or had been shot to pieces by the flak. All the lights, horns, and klaxons were going at once as the plane protested with a great crescendo of whines, groans, and the howling noise coming through the exploded windscreens. My father looked over at Colonel Hunter and realized that he was already dead, hit by flak or some bit of flying metal from the fractured plane. Upside down, spinning, he groped for the parachute beneath his seat. They'd started at 27,000 feet, and he had no idea how high they were, but knew he had to get out. The flyers were supposed to wear their parachutes at all times, but the salty old dogs, as my father was then at age 23, kept them under their seats, because the damn things were so uncomfortable to sit on for 10 hours. And anyway, the choices they gave you were, as the flyers like to say, exceedingly butt-puckering, inasmuch as a pilot descending beneath a 40-foot canopy made a great target for sharpshooters. Even the farmers came out to try their hand at bagging an American flyer. The women and children would be gathering, too, to collect the bounty from a shattered B-17, nylon, wool, plastic, metal of all sorts, and silk from parachutes and from the escape and evasion maps. He couldn't reach his parachute with the stupid harness on, so he released it. The centrifugal force slammed him into the instrument panel with such force that it nearly knocked him out. It cut off his oxygen supply, which was fed through a thick rubber tube running up his chest to his face mask. Smashed against the instrument panel, losing altitude he knew not how fast, he reached up with a hand that seemed made of lead now and pulled the face mask off to get a breath of air. He saw Hunter flopped over, hanging helplessly in his harness. He took a breath. Damn. Probably still above 20,000 feet, he thought, and passed out from hypoxia. While he was out, his aircraft broke in two amidships. On the ground, an old woman, Mrs. Pfeiffer, saw something amazing. Boys falling out of the sky. Of the 10-man crew, only my father survived, and he was severely injured, as might be anticipated, in a 5-mile fall. When he awoke, the motion had stopped. He was crumpled and jammed beneath the instrument panel down by the big naked aluminum rudder pedals. He saw a sky outside the shattered canopy, a placental overcast from which he'd been born. A man appeared in the broken window frame, standing on the stub of the right wing. He pointed a pistol at my father's head. He was a local man, a German peasant. The idea of killing an American pilot was not an unpopular one in those parts. My father watched with detached curiosity as the man pulled the trigger. In 1958, when I was 10 years old, I worked in a medical school laboratory at the Houston Medical Center. My father was a biophysicist there. I convinced him to take me to work with him so that I could find out what he did, which he didn't seem able to explain. I'd been after him about it since I was very little, and by the time I was 5, I had started to think that he might have been in the slow group at scientist school. All the other fathers could explain what they did. When I was 8, he started taking me to the lab with him after school and on weekends and letting me wash glassware and do other menial jobs. But gradually he gave me more responsibility. I learned to make microscope slides before I learned how to dance. One of my earliest jobs in the lab was to take the trash to the incinerator. The trash often consisted of cut-up mice and such things as come out of a biological sciences lab. So I'd lug the trash bags down the vast tiled corridor, which was dimly lit from either side by the glass vitrines in which the demonstration specimens floated in their baths of formalin. There was a human head sliced into half-inch thick slabs, neat as you please. There were many fetuses at various stages of development. And there was one lady, headless, armless, her torso cut in half from the top of her sternum to her crotch. She floated in formalin like a nightmare of Botticelli's Venus, about to be born on an ocean wave. I proceeded to the furnace and cranked the steel handle until the heavy rusted door opened to reveal a roaring orange inferno within. I was just about to toss in the trash bags when I saw a human arm sticking up out of the flames. At first I was shocked, then frightened. Then I realized that, of course, that's where Venus's arms must have gone long ago, along with a lot of other spare parts. And I thought, what the heck am I doing here? I couldn't answer the question then, but I can now. I was chasing my father, trying to get some of that righteous stuff he had. What else does a son do but try to learn from his father? Since he was a scientist, I grew up believing in science. That meant I had, before I even knew it, already embarked on a search for some universal laws, the rules of life. My interest in survival began early, when I was a child and learned what my father had done in the war. That he had lived while so many others had died seemed to me to have so much meaning. I heard the stories over and over and could never seem to plumb their mystery. His survival made me believe that he had some special, ineffable quality. I felt urgently that I ought to have it, too. Gradually, I developed the idea that to survive, you must first be annealed in the fires of peril. Even his everyday life seemed a peril. All around him were the dead, yet he lived on, laughing. Eventually, I went looking for my own brand of peril. I deliberately took risks so that I might survive them. We lived on a bayou in southeast Texas, and from about the time I was 7, it was my private wilderness, with alligators and snapping turtles, rattlesnakes and water moccasins, and strange, displaced characters. My Irish Catholic German mother had so many babies, who could keep track of them all? I pretty much ran wild. When I was in the 4th grade, I began writing about the risks I took. By the time I was in my 20s, I was doing it as a journalist. After 30 years, I realized I'd been writing about survival all along without knowing it, but I'd always come home from a story wondering, do I have it now? Am I a survivor? Or is there more? I became a pilot. I began writing about big aviation accidents, that boundary between life and death where my father had made his bones. With my interest in science, then, I thought there must be some research that could help me to understand the mysteries of survival I'd encountered. I found otherwise rational people doing inexplicable things to get themselves killed, against all advice, against all reason. A perfectly sensible man on a snowmobile is warned not to go up a hill because it will probably produce a fatally large avalanche. He goes up anyway and dies. A firefighter, an experienced outdoorsman, knows he is going in the wrong direction but persists anyway and winds up profoundly lost in the wilderness. A number of scuba divers are found dead with air in their tanks. They pulled the regulators from their mouths and died. If you had magically transported them to the surface a moment before they removed their regulators and asked them about their impulse, they would have told you that it made no sense. The regulator was necessary for their survival. If you were able to ask them afterward, they would tell you that they didn't intend to take it out. They intended to live. After reading hundreds of accident reports and writing scores of articles, I began to wonder if there wasn't some mysterious force hidden within us that produces such mad behavior. Most people find it hard to believe that reason doesn't control our actions. We believe in free will and rational behavior. The difficulty with those assumptions comes when we see rational people doing irrational things. Those who survive are just as baffling. I knew, for example, that an experienced hunter might perish while lost in the woods for a single night, whereas a 4-year-old might survive. When 5 people are set adrift at sea and only 2 come back, what makes the difference? Who survived Nazi prison camps? Why did Scott's crew perish in Antarctica while, against all odds, Shackleton's crew survived and even thrived in the same circumstances? Why was a 17-year-old girl able to walk out of the Peruvian jungle while the adults who were lost with her sat down and died? It was maddening to find survival so unpredictable because, after all, science seeks predictability. But as I raked the ashes of catastrophe, I began to see the outlines of an explanation. Most of what I discovered through the years of research and reporting was not new. I acquainted myself with recent research on the way the brain functions, but also with fundamental principles that have been around for centuries, in some cases thousands of years, as well as with the psychology of risk-taking and survival. The principles apply to wilderness survival, but they also apply to any stressful, demanding situation, such as getting through a divorce, losing a job, surviving illness, recovering from an injury, or running a business in a rapidly changing world. It's easy to imagine that wilderness survival would involve equipment, training, and experience. It turns out that at the moment of truth, those might be good things to have, but they aren't decisive. Those of us who go into the wilderness or seek our thrills in contact with the forces of nature soon learn, in fact, that experience, training, and modern equipment can betray you. The maddening thing for someone with a Western scientific turn of mind is that it's not what's in your pack that separates the quick from the dead. It's not even what's in your mind. Corny as it sounds, it's what's in your heart. The farther one goes, the less one knows. Tao Te Ching. How did I get into this and this, and how do I get out of it again? How does it end? Soren Kierkegaard. Part 1. How Accidents Happen. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself, in its own construction? Marcus Aurelius. 1. Look out, here comes Ray Charles. If you could see adrenaline, then you'd see a great greasy river of it oozing off the beach at San Diego tonight. You'd see it flowing 100 miles out toward the stern of the boat. That's what the pilots call it, a boat, despite the fact that it displaces 95,000 tons of water, has a minimum of 6,000 people living on board at all times, and is as long as the Empire State Building is tall. I'm standing with a half a dozen sweaty guys on the LSO platform, which at 8 by 8 feet seems very crowded just now. We're steaming into the prevailing wind at around 30 knots, the exact speed being classified, and I'm trying not to be jostled toward the 70-foot gulp down to the water. The steel blade of this boat has ripped up the belly of the sea, and I watch for a moment as its curling intestines glisten with moonlight and roll away behind us. On my left is Mike Yankovich, the landing signal officer, LSO, in his goggles and cranial, his gaze fixed intently about 15 degrees above the horizon. He's got a heavy-looking telephone handset pressed to his left ear, pickle switch held high in his right hand. It's called the pickle switch because it looks like a large Bakelite kosher pickle with a silver ring enclosing a black trigger. Yankovich has his index finger and thumb poised to press the cut light or wave off light switches in case he needs to tell the pilot to add power or not to land. The men inadvertently nudge me toward the edge in their enthusiasm to get a look at the F-18 Hornet that's bearing down on us at 150 miles an hour. A mile out, it doesn't look like much yet, just a black dart, a darker darkness in a sky full of buzz-bomb stars. I know those monster GE engines are burning kerosene faster than a V-2 rocket, but I can't hear them yet. There's just that silent insect shape, unfolding like an origami airplane, a black bat in the bat-black night. I look at the faces around me. Each man has a lump in his cheek from the Tootsie Roll Pops a Marine passed out a few minutes ago. Their white eyes stare intently at the blossoming shape that's chewing up the stars. But they're not staring the way I'm staring. They're different. They're like kids waiting their turn on the roller coaster. And as the plane, 56 feet long, 40 feet wide, heads straight for us, I'm thinking, we're all going to die. The place where that huge machine is meant to land stretches away only a few feet from us. I can see the dashed white foul line shining against the black non-skid deck. Foul meaning you step over it, you die. We are standing beside the arrival end of a very short runway built onto the deck of the boat. It stretches away toward the bow at an angle to the keel. The arresting cables, gray and greasy, slither away toward the starboard side. The theory is that the pilot will come in just right and the hook dangling from his tail will catch one of the four wires which will stop him. The rest of the deck is a chaos of action as planes refuel and taxi and launch. The A-6s and F-18s and the sexy old Tomcats, last of the stick-and-rudder airplanes, lumbering like slow beasts to the motions of the yellow shirts and the grapes, purple shirts, in their goggles and cranials, who rotate their gauntlet-gloved hands in cryptic signals as the airplanes taxi and queue up for the cat. In the wild deck lights, with the cacophonous metallic music, it has the air of an atavistic ritual with mighty flaming totems. If I turn around, I can just see the shooter peering out of his bathyscaphe bubble in the deck plates in an eerie sulfur light. There goes another one now. Ka-chunk whoosh, in a sleet storm of metal particles, and this amazing hissing scream like someone's tearing a hole in hell. Then two angry afterburner eyes seem to hang motionless in the darkness as the bat shape shinnies up a pigtail of smoke and is gone. I hear Yankovic through the headphones inside my cranial and turn back to the F-18 bearing down on us. He's speaking over the telephone handset. The pilot's quaking voice responds, 314 Hornet BB Ball 3.2. Roger, Ball. Wind 20 knots axial. He's at a quarter mile, a child in a glass bubble, alone in the night with the dying yellow stars of deck lights below, the cold wind whittling curls of cloud off the cheesy moon, the whistling thunder at his back as he hurtles toward the heaving sea, straddling two gigantic flamethrowers. At last we feel the concussion through our feet. The two-wire, that great fat cable, is turned into a singing liquid instrument by the shock. Ravi Shankar meets the Terminator. It catches the plane like a fish, playing it out 200 feet. The plane shudders all over as the pilot, Del Rio by name, I had seen it painted on his cockpit rail, hangs in his harness in total G-shock for a moment before he can reach up with a hand that seems to weigh 40 pounds and pull the throttle back to idle. Now the yellow shirts wave him toward the huffer cart where the grapes will refuel him, so that he can go up and do it again. Del Rio's performance was a perfect act of survival. There he was, safe on the deck of a big boat. He climbed into a machine full of explosive fuel and had himself shot off into the night with a nuclear steam cat. Then, using only his skill and his superior emotional control, he brought himself back by the remarkable performance of catching a wire that he could not see with a hook that he could not see, using cues that made no natural sense while going 150 miles an hour in the black-ass night. Most of us will never get into quite the same jam as Del Rio, but every survival situation is the same in its essence, and so there are lessons to be learned tonight. The first lesson is to remain calm, not to panic. Because emotions are called hot cognitions, this is known as being cool. Cool as a slang expression goes back to the 1800s, but its contemporary sense originated with African-American jazz musicians in the 1940s. Jazz was cool compared with the hot, emotional bebop it had begun to overshadow. Some researchers suggest that African-American jazz musicians refused to let themselves get hot, get angry, in the face of racism. Instead, they remained outwardly calm and channeled emotion into music as a survival strategy in a hostile environment. They turned fear and anger into focus. And focus is just a metaphorical way of saying that they were able to concentrate their attention on the matter at hand. I'd been searching all my life for that state of cool I'd seen my father exhibit, because it had brought him home in one piece. Well, a lot of pieces, actually, but they'd knitted back together, more or less, by the time I was born. Only 10 to 20% of people can stay calm and think in the midst of a survival emergency. They are the ones who can perceive their situation clearly. They can plan and take correct action, all of which are key elements of survival. Confronted with a changing environment, they rapidly adapt. Those are the kind of pilots who are supposed to be flying off the deck of the Carl Vinson tonight. Getting back onto the deck is the final exam. I'd seen Del Rio earlier when he came in a bit late for the 1800 briefing in Ready 9, a steel room where we were all slouched in comfortable maroon Naugahyde chairs, trying to look like we weren't scared out of our wits. Every few minutes the catapult shook the whole boat, ka-chunk, whoosh, as if we were taking Exocet missile fire. Nobody even flinched. Yankovich had just begun the briefing for these, his students, when Del Rio walked in, having obviously gotten up from a nap. The side of his face still bore the imprint of the pillow. "Hey, got a little rack burn there," Yankovich remarked.
"Practicing for the luge run?"
"They call it the luge run because when you're trying to sleep in those tiny racks and the boat is churning along through the waves and planes are exploding off the deck over your head, it feels like the Winter Olympics meets World War III." Yankovich, a square-jawed, athletic-looking youth with brown hair, green eyes, and a big grin, knew he could tease Del Rio, because in such a place of hypervigilance as this, where nothing, no matter how subtle, went unnoticed, everyone knew, without even having to stop and consider it, that to be able to drop off to sleep 2 hours before your first night carrier landing was to display a righteous and masterful state of coolness. I'd gone to stay on the Carl Vinson as part of my lifelong fascination with that boundary region between life and death, that place where to stay alive, you have to remain calm and alert. The reason it's a boundary region is that not everyone can do it. Some fail. Some die. Shortly before I arrived, one of the pilots was on final, heading toward the deck. He let his descent rate get away from him, and got low and slow, and, well, some would use the term panic, but that doesn't tell us much. There were plenty of sensory signals screaming at him that he'd better get on the power. His hand was already on the throttle. All he had to do was move it a few inches. The LSO had hit the pickle switch, activating those glaring red lights that mean you are not cleared to land. The ball, an obvious light and a big Fresnel lens, was right in front of him, telling him he was low. And, of course, the LSO was also yelling in his ear. Somehow none of it got through. The impact with the tail of the boat cut the plane in two, leaving his WSO, the guy in the rear seat, squashed like a bug on a windshield, and sending the pilot skittering across the deck in a shower of sparks, still strapped into his Martin Baker ejection seat. The pilot lived, and although I'm not sure he got to try that trick again, I'm reasonably certain that he got to have lunch with the captain. But the most mystifying thing was how he could have kept on coming toward the boat in the face of so much information telling him not to. That was the real boundary I was after. What was he thinking? He was smart, well-prepared, and highly trained. Something powerful had blocked it all, and something had forced him to reach for the deck despite all the information he had that it was a bad idea. It reminded me of a lot of accidents in the wilderness and in risky outdoor sports, river running, for example, where people ignore the obvious and do the inexplicable. That was the mystery I'd been trying to unravel. What the pilots on the Carl Vinson know is this. Shit does just happen sometimes, as the bumper sticker says. There are things you can't control, so you'd better know how you're going to react to them. Yankovich explained it to me. The launch bar breaks. The shuttle goes supersonic and hits the water break. The water break turns instantly to steam from all that energy and explodes. Deck plates come flying up, and you fly right through the deck plates as you take off. So you eject and land on the deck. That's what's known in fighter pilot parlance as not your day. But there are also the things you can control, and you'd better be controlling them all the time. So this is how Yankovich began the 1800 briefing in Ready 9 on the Carl Vinson that night. It will scare the living shit out of you. If you taxi to the cat and you don't have a knot in your stomach, there's something wrong. It's like walking into a closet. You're going to go right off into a black hole. You're sitting there sucking oxygen. You'd better have a plan, because if you don't, you're screwed, and then you're fucked. We'd all seen the two helicopters orbiting out there, in case someone went into the water, and the big yellow crane to pick up planes that got stuck halfway over the side. And those were for the lucky guys. The first rule is face reality. Good survivors aren't immune to fear. They know what's happening, and it does scare the living shit out of them. It's all a question of what you do next. The briefing was not about imparting technical knowledge. If those guys didn't know that stuff already, they wouldn't be sitting here with their names stenciled on the backs of their chairs. Nicknames, actually. Hairball, Eel, Cracker, So Dog, Stubby. Part of the briefing was to remind them of stuff they already knew, the way a hymn does in church, but nothing too complex, because in what psychologists would call their high state of arousal, nothing too complex was going to get through anyway. No. The briefing was more about how Yankovic said things. And how he said them was with a dark, dark humor. It was a little ritual in which everyone was reminded how to look death in the face and still come up with a wry smile. In a true survival situation, you are by definition looking death in the face. And if you can't find something droll, and even something wondrous and inspiring in it, you are already in a world of hurt. Al Siebert, a psychologist and author of The Survivor Personality, writes that survivors laugh at threats. Playing and laughing go together. Playing keeps the person in contact with what is happening around him. To deal with reality, you must first recognize it as such. In keeping with that view, the pilots on the Carl Vinson rarely talked earnestly about the risk this close to flight time. They joked about it instead. Because if you let yourself get too serious, you will get too scared. And once that devil is out of the bottle, you're on a runaway horse. Fear is good. Too much fear is not. Yankovic continued his briefing. The steam curtain comes up and you lose the yellow shirt for a minute. You'll be a hero real quick if you have the fold handle in the wrong position, so check that. Spread 'em, five potatoes, and you're all set. Okay, wipe out. The engines come up. See that they match. The safety guys jump up and make sure the beer cans are down. Tension signal. Hands you off to the shooter and then head back in 4 G's. Grab the towel rack. Touch the ejection seat handle and make sure you're not sitting on it. If you lose an engine on the cat, stroke the blowers. 12 to 14, not to exceed 16. Rad alt, you see you're descending, the wiser man will grab the handle. What the hell did he just say? The first time I heard a briefing like that, I was lost. But that's part of the point. Only those who get it, get it. A nod is as good as a wink to a blind horse. Just for the record, what Yankovic said was that it would be a very bad idea to try to depart with your wings folded up, as they are for taxiing around on the deck. It takes 5 seconds for them to lock down into place after you move the handle, so you count off as follows. 1 potato, 2 potato, 3 potato. Then, after all the technical bits of the launch process have been checked, the wipeout with a stick to make sure your controls are moving freely, checking to see that the engines are both producing the same amount of power, and so on, you're going to hold on to a metal bar known as the towel rack, because that's what it looks like, to keep yourself from being slammed back by the force of the catapult. And just in case that isn't complicated enough, remember that one of your engines could quit, in which case you have to put the other engine into afterburner, known as the blower because it blows, to get enough power to keep going up. But don't overspeed it. Those engines are expensive. And since nothing ever works out as planned, check the radar altimeter, which will tell you if you're sinking, in which case wisdom would dictate that you depart the aircraft with some haste. Of course, it would be unthinkable to talk like that because, for one thing, anybody could understand you. For another, it would be terrifying. And after all that, there is still the little matter of landing the aircraft, because, as my father used to say, takeoff is optional, but landing is mandatory. Yankovic explained the most salient points. You're at a quarter mile and someone asks you who your mother is. You don't know. That's how focused you are. Okay, call the ball. Now it's a knife fight in a phone booth. And remember, full power in the wire. Your IQ rolls back to that of an ape. It sounds as if he's being a smartass. He is. But deep lessons also are there to be teased out, like some obscure Talmudic script. Lessons about survival. About what you need to know and what you don't need to know. About the surface of the brain and its deep recesses. About what you know that you don't know you know, and about what you don't know that you'd better not think you know. Call it an ape. Call it a horse, as Plato did. Plato understood that emotions could trump reason, and that to succeed we have to use the reins of reason on the horse of emotion. That turns out to be remarkably close to what modern research has begun to show us, and it works both ways. The intellect without the emotions is like the jockey without the horse. My father didn't fly after the war, and he hardly ever talked about it as such. But when he did, I listened. He used to say, "When you walk across the ramp to your airplane, you lose half your IQ." I always wondered what he meant, but instinctively I felt it. When I was a new pilot, I'd get so excited before a flight that I'd get tunnel vision. I'd look at a checklist and be unable to read beyond the first item. Check master switch. Off. Sometimes I'd just sit there in the left seat, hyperventilating. After years of working at it, flying upside down, flying jets and helicopters, and having a few confidence builders, I got to the point where nearly every flight was almost pure joy. I say almost because even today there is the residual anxiety before each flight, the knot in the stomach that tells me I'm not a fool, that I know I'm taking a calculated risk in pitting my skill and control against a complex, tightly coupled, unstable system with a lot of energy in it. I'll always be the tiny jockey on a half-ton of hair-trigger muscle. Fear puts me in my place. It gives me the humility to see things as they are. I get the same feeling before I go rock climbing or surfing, or before I slap on my snowboard and plunge off into a backcountry wilderness that could swallow me up and not spit me out again. So Yankovic was telling his pilots something that was not only very important to their survival, but that is scientifically sound. Be aware that you're not all there. You are in a profoundly altered state when it comes to perception, cognition, memory, and emotion. He was trying to keep them calm while letting them face reality. He'd seen people die. He knew the power of the horse, and these were his precious jet jockeys. What you really need to know for survival purposes, whether it's in a jet or in the wilderness, is that the system we call emotion, from the Latin verb emovere, to move away, works powerfully and quickly to motivate behavior. Eric Maria Remarque described it perfectly in All Quiet on the Western Front, in which he fictionalized his experiences at the front in World War I. At the sound of the first droning of the shells, we rush back, in one part of our being, 1,000 years. By the animal instinct that is awakened in us, we are led and protected. It is not conscious. It is far quicker, much more sure, less fallible than consciousness. One cannot explain it. A man is walking along without thought or heed. Suddenly he throws himself down on the ground, and a storm of fragments flies harmlessly over him. Yet he cannot remember either to have heard the shell coming or to have thought of flinging himself down. But had he not abandoned himself to the impulse, he would now be a heap of mangled flesh. It is this other, this second sight in us, that has thrown us to the ground and saved us, without our knowing how. If it were not so, there would not be one man alive from Flanders to the Vosges. Now we can explain it, at least better than we could when Remarque wrote his novel. Emotion is an instinctive response aimed at self-preservation. It involves numerous bodily changes that are preparations for action. The nervous system fires more energetically. The blood changes its chemistry so that it can coagulate more rapidly. Muscle tone alters. Digestion stops, and various chemicals flood the body to put it in a state of high readiness for whatever needs to be done. All of that happens outside of conscious control. Reason is tentative, slow, and fallible, while emotion is sure, quick, and unhesitating. The oldest medical and philosophical model, going back to the Greeks, was of a unified organism in which mind was part of and integral to the body. Plato, on the other hand, thought of mind and body as separate, with the soul going on after death. Aristotle brought them back together again. But it seems that people have been struggling with the split for a very long time indeed. probably because they innately feel as if they have minds that are somehow distinct from their bodies. After the Renaissance, a Cartesian model emerged in which the mind existed alone, had no location, and was completely independent of the body. To the neuroscientist, the brain is no longer seen as separate, but is now considered an integral part of the body, no less so than heart, lungs, and liver. Moreover, many researchers now regard what we experience as mind and consciousness as a side effect, albeit a useful one in evolutionary terms, of the brain's synaptic functioning. Certainly, they all agree that the brain is as affected by the body as the body is by the brain. In fact, the brain is created in part by the body, the other main influence being the environment, in the sense that what the brain does or is capable of doing comes from its synaptic connections, and those connections are forged through what the brain comes to know of the body and the environment. Thinking is a bodily function, as are emotions and feelings. As Antonio R. Damasio points out in his best-selling book on the brain, Descartes' Error, "I think, therefore I am" has become "I am, therefore I think." The brain is the only organ that has no clear function. It makes you breathe, but it's not part of the respiratory system. It controls blood pressure and circulation, but it's not part of the circulatory system either. The concept of body has no meaning without the brain and its extensive network of projections that reach to nearly every cell. As an eminent neuroscientist, Damasio is as qualified as anyone to define the brain, and he calls it an organ of information and government. He put the word organ in quotes because it's not exactly an organ either. The information he writes about is of three kinds: information about the environment, information about the body, and information about the good or bad consequences of interactions between the two. The term government refers to the fact that the brain's functions are largely regulatory in nature. The brain provides a continuously changing kaleidoscope of images concerning the state of the environment and the state of the body. It receives images from receptors in the body and from the sense organs that take in the outside world. The images can be smells, sights, sounds, or feelings. At the same time, the brain provides a stream of outputs that shape the body's reactions to the environment and to itself, from adjusting blood pressure to mating. So the brain reads the state of the body and makes fine adjustments, even while it reads the environment and directs the body in reacting to it. In addition, that process continually reshapes the brain by making new connections. All of this is aimed at one thing only: adaptation, which is another word for survival. The brain does that job mostly through unconscious learning. It learns, or adapts, by strengthening the electrochemical transmissions among neurons and creating new sites at which neurons can communicate with each other. Axons, the fibers that send signals, grow and form new branches and synapses. Memory is the result. Doing almost anything generates new links among neurons. The process of learning something and the essence of memory has been observed by neuroscientists in the lab. Genes make new proteins in order to store information, and they make new proteins in order to bring that information back as a memory. This process is called reconsolidation, because as Joseph Ledoux, a neuroscientist and author of The Synaptic Self, put it, the brain that does the remembering is not the brain that formed the initial memory. In order for the old memory to make sense in the current brain, the memory has to be updated. This is one reason why memory is notoriously faulty. There is a new split, too, between cognition and emotion. Cognition means reason and conscious thought, mediated by language, images, and logical processes. Emotion refers to a specific set of bodily changes in reaction to the environment, the body, or to images produced by memory. Cognition is capable of making fine calculations and abstract distinctions. Emotion is capable of producing powerful physical actions. The human organism, then, is like a jockey on a thoroughbred in the gate. He's a small man, and it's a big horse. and if it decides to get excited in that small metal cage, the jockey is going to get mangled, possibly killed. So he takes great care to be gentle. The jockey is reason, and the horse is emotion. A complex of systems bred over eons of evolution and shaped by experience, which exist for your survival. They are so powerful, they can make you do things you'd never think to do, and they can allow you to do things you'd never believe yourself capable of doing. The jockey can't win without the horse, and the horse can't race alone. In the gate, they are two, and it's dangerous. But when they run, they are one, and it's positively godly. The horse can be amazingly strong. On Mother's Day 1999, St. John Eberle and his partner, Mark Beverly, were climbing in New Mexico's Sandia Mountain Wilderness when a rock weighing more than 500 pounds fell on Eberle, pinning him. Beverly watched as Eberle lifted the rock off of himself. Of course, no one can lift a 500-pound rock. Then again, Eberle did it. When I was reporting on airline accidents in the 1980s, an investigator told me of finding dead pilots who had ripped the huge control columns out of jumbo jets while trying to pull up the nose of a crippled plane. That horse can either work for us or against us. It can win the race or explode in the gate. So it is learning when to soothe and gentle it and when to let it run that marks the winning jockey, the true survivor. And that is what the dark humor of various subcultures is all about. It's about gentling the beast, keeping it cool. And when it's time to run, it's about letting it flow, about having emotion and reason in perfect balance. That's what characterizes elite performers, from Tiger Woods to Neil Armstrong. There are primary emotions and secondary emotions. Primary emotions are the ones you're born with, such as the drive to obtain food, or the reaction of reaching out to grab something if you feel yourself falling. But the emotional system of bodily responses can be hooked up to anything. Remarks soldiers learn to connect a deeply instinctive emotional response to the whistling of a shell. There were no high explosive shells when emotion evolved, but it is handily recruited into the task of avoiding them after only a few experiences to make the connection. The connection once made is so profound that taking the necessary action requires no thought or will. It works automatically. The proof that it's a secondary and not a primary emotion is that the new recruits didn't have the same reaction, and they died by the score as a result. Remarks observation, and the neuroscience that has confirmed it, can illuminate the way accidents happen. If an experienced river runner is pitched into the water, he will turn on his back and float with his toes out of the water, riding on the buoyancy of his life vest. An inexperienced one, like a drowning swimmer, will reach up to wave or try to grab something. Raising his arms causes his feet to sink. 44-year-old Peter Duffy died on June 16, 1996, while rafting on the Hudson River. And his accident illustrates how important it is not only to control emotions, but to develop the appropriate secondary emotions. He, Duffy, fell into the river, wrote Charlie Walbridge, who publishes River Safety Report. Facing upstream, he attempted to stand, caught his right foot between two rocks, and was pushed under. His life jacket was stripped off, and he was trapped under 3 feet of water. Foot entrapment rescues are very difficult. You might as well step in front of a speeding car as get your foot caught in a fast-moving river. The victim was warned, but failed to follow instructions. Duffy knew intellectually what he should have done, but knowing was no match for emotion. Fear is but one emotion. The instinct to reproduce is another, and it initiates a remarkably similar set of visceral responses, though with striking differences involving the sex organs and glands. Anyone who has ever fallen in love, fallen hard, knows what Yankovic means when he says, "Your IQ rolls back to that of an ape." Emotion takes over from the thinking part of the brain, the neocortex, to effect an instinctive set of responses necessary for survival, in this case, reproduction. During a fear reaction, the amygdala, as with most structures in the brain, there are two of them, one in each hemisphere, in concert with numerous other structures in the brain and body, help to trigger a staggeringly complex sequence of events, all aimed at producing a behavior to promote survival. Freezing in place, for example, followed by running away. When the reaction begins, neural networks are activated and numerous chemical compounds are released and moved around in the brain and body. The most well-known among them is the so-called adrenaline rush. Adrenaline is a trade name for epinephrine, and adrenaline is a synonym for it, but neither is used much in scientific circles. Epinephrine and norepinephrine, which come from the adrenal glands, are in a class of compounds called catecholamines, which have a wide range of effects, including constricting blood vessels and exciting or inhibiting the firing of nerve cells and the contraction of smooth muscle fibers. But it is norepinephrine, not adrenaline or epinephrine, that is largely responsible for the jolt you feel in the heart when startled. Cortisol, a steroid, which is released from the adrenal cortex, also amps up fear, among its other effects. The net result of all the chemicals that come streaming through your system once the amygdala has detected danger is that the heart rate rises, breathing speeds up, more sugar is dumped into the metabolic system, and the distribution of oxygen and nutrients shifts so that you have the strength to run or fight. You're on afterburner. The knot in the stomach Yankovic mentioned results from that redistribution, as well as from contractions of the smooth muscle in the stomach, in which the flow of blood to the digestive system is reduced so that it can be used elsewhere to meet the emergency. Excellent descriptions of this very complex system can be found in Joseph Ledoux's books, The Emotional Brain and the Synaptic Self. He refers to the amygdala as the centerpiece of the defense system. Evolution took millions of years to come up with emotional responses. It has not yet had time to come up with an appropriate survival response for Navy fighter pilots on quarter-mile final, trying to land a 50,000-pound stovepipe on the heaving deck of a ship. Peter Duffy's lack of control over his emotional response allowed him to drown himself in the Hudson River. The fighter pilot who slammed into the back of the Carl Vinson was the victim of a similar effect. A secondary emotion got the best of him on the approach to the boat. For whatever reason, he was not exercising the necessary control, and he let the plane get too low. I know how it works. I've done it myself. Most pilots have. Fear in the cockpit, as Yankovic put it, is a knife fight in a phone booth. You literally have to fight to move your frozen hand to correct the mistake that you see developing before your eyes. You are split. Many times before, the pilot must have had the sensation of torn-buckle, twisting terror, followed by the cool flood of relief upon landing. Even as the hormones produced under stress disrupt perception, thinking, and the formation and retrieval of memories, they set a potentially dangerous trap by exciting the amygdala. They help to dampen explicit, conscious memory, even while creating and recalling implicit, unconscious memories with greater efficiency. As the fear rises, you become more unable to deal with it because you're not even aware of the learning that's propelling you. Ledoux refers to this as a hostile takeover of consciousness by emotion, as the amygdala comes to dominate working memory. The body knows where safety is, and when you're a rookie and really afraid, any successful landing carries with it an explosive, almost orgasmic sense of release. The pilot had developed a powerful secondary emotion, which told him that safety and even ecstasy could be found on the ground or on the deck, and that if he could just get the hell down, he'd be all right. He had a true and physical memory of that sensation, which was a powerful motivator of behavior, developed by coupling that experience with a primary emotional state. He also had an intellectual knowledge that if you land when you're already low and slow, you might die. Unfortunately, he had no secondary emotion for that, since he had no experience of it. It was an abstract idea, forebrain stuff. It could not compete as a motivator of behavior. When a pilot hits the round down, as they call the back of the boat, it's called a ramp strike. As one pilot who flew in the war on Iraq said, "Those are bad and deadly." He explained the way it happens. The pilot focuses too much on the thing that he feels is most important at that moment, the deck. Home. It's called spotting the deck because it breaks up the natural flow of his scan, which ought to include his meatball, lineup, airspeed, altimeter, and angle of attack. Once he fixes on his landing area, he's done for. The pilot's rising curve of fear went off the charts in one direction, while the rising curve of his motivation toward the deck went off the charts in the other. The jockey lost control of the horse in the gate. Experienced travelers in the wilderness and people who engage in risky activities understand. In 1910, two British explorers, Apsley Cherry Garrard and Robert Falcon Scott, set off for the South Pole. Scott died on that expedition. In praising his traveling companions, Cherry Garrard wrote that they displayed that quality which is perhaps the only one which may be said with certainty to make for success, self-control. How well you exercise that control often decides the outcome of survival situations. Whether it means making a split-second decision while scuba or skydiving, or keeping your head while stranded in the wilderness, it is the most important skill to take along. And with more and more novices going into the wilderness for fun, the severe penalties that come with a failure of control are becoming evident in the increasing number of search and rescue operations that are launched to save them or recover their bodies. Stress releases cortisol into the blood. It invades the hippocampus and interferes with its work. Long-term stress can kill hippocampal cells. The amygdala has powerful connections to the sensory cortices, the rhinal cortex, the anterior cingulate, and the ventral prefrontal cortex, which means that the entire memory system, both input and output, are affected. As a result, most people are incapable of performing any but the simplest tasks under stress. They can't remember the most basic things. In addition, stress, or any strong emotion, erodes the ability to perceive. Cortisol and other hormones released under stress interfere with the working of the prefrontal cortex. That is where perceptions are processed and decisions are made. You see less, hear less, miss more cues from the environment, and make mistakes. Under extreme stress, the visual field actually narrows. Police officers who have been shot report tunnel vision. Stress causes most people to focus narrowly on the thing that they consider most important, and it may be the wrong thing. So while the fighter pilot was fixed on landing, he very well might not have seen the lights or even heard the LSO's voice telling him to go around. The organism was doing what it knew how to do best, escape danger and get to safety as fast as possible. The rest of the input became irrelevant noise, efficiently screened out by the brain. So he hit the boat. I did something very like that when I was a new pilot. I was on approach to landing at my home airport when the controller told me I was on a collision course with another plane. But I was so focused, so fearful, that I literally didn't hear him. I heard nothing, and I didn't even see the plane. He called me on the radio 3 times. And fortunately, my friend Jonas, who was sitting beside me, told me that the controller wanted an immediate right turn. The task of just getting the hell down had become so important, so emotionally motivated, that it occupied what neuroscientists call working memory, which in effect means consciousness or attention to the exclusion of other stimuli. Only because Jonas was so close to me and could command my attention by punching me in the arm was he able to break the lock I had put on working memory. Emotions are survival mechanisms, but they don't always work for the individual. They work across a large number of trials to keep the species alive. The individual may live or die, but over a few million years, more mammals lived than died by letting emotion take over, and so emotion was selected. For people who are raised in modern civilization, the wilderness is novel and full of unfamiliar hazards. To survive in it, the body must learn and adapt. Although strong emotion can interfere with the ability to reason,